Oyez, oyez, oyez. A person has risen before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3091, United States of America versus Mark McCarty, appellant. Mr. Zucker for appellant, Mr. Smith for appellee.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jonathan Zucker along with Patricia Doss on behalf of Appellant McCarty. My inclination is to submit on the 40-year supervised term of supervision and argue simply the conditions of release. The plain error standard would apply, and basically if the conditions are appropriate, then it doesn't matter what standard would apply. So the first question I think we have to address in this case is, were those conditions appropriate? To be appropriate, the condition has to be related to the offense, defendant's history and characteristics. It has to apply to the need for deterrence, protection of public safety, or relate to treatment of the defendant. The issue of concern here is that no greater deprivation of liberty than is necessary. The conditions of release should have no greater deprivation of liberty than is necessary to provide adequate deterrence, protect the public, or further the defendant's rehabilitation. The three conditions of release that are challenged, there were several conditions of release, only three are challenged. The first is the internet restriction, that the defendant for 40 years cannot use any computer with access to online services, essentially the internet, without the prior approval of the probation office. The second condition was that he shall not patronize any place where pornography or erotica can be accessed or is expressly offered. And the third was that he shall participate in drug treatment, or actually alcohol treatment, but the discretion whether that be inpatient or outpatient was delegated to the probation officer rather than decided by the judge.
But this is a case in which the internet was a part of the crime here.
Yes.
So what is the problem with this being a condition?
I think certainly that it be a condition is not a problem. It is the wholesale nature of the restriction, the length of the restriction, and the absence of any guidance to the probation officer that creates the issue in this case. And this case really is the case that was presaged or anticipated in the Love decision, where essentially the same issue was dealt with, but the distinction noted by that court was, when the internet is used to transport or access pornography, one level of supervision is warranted versus when it is used for that purpose, in addition to facilitating the abuse of children. And in
that's certainly a factor to distinguish the cases. But does that distinction control a different outcome here?
I would say yes. I would say
the court here found that the defendant's use of the internet was particularly heinous and egregious, right? I mean, she made that point.
No, I think with the point, and I won't say she didn't make that point, but I think the distinction here, certainly the images conveyed were heinous, repulsive, repugnant, whatever bad adjective you want to apply.
His statements accompanying them were as well, right?
But it was not, the distinction is that in this case it was not used to facilitate the abuse of children.
True.
And that was the distinction.
But can't the trial court, on the basis of the facts that she found, the nature of the images, the nature of the communications on the internet, not facilitation, but just
right,
the nature of the statement, that you think that is not a sufficient reason for her to have imposed this condition on the supervised release?
I think it puts her decision is at odds with other precedent from other jurisdictions, which drew that distinction.
Is there a clear legal rule that she violated in doing that? That's what you have to show under plain error, right? That there's legal rule.
I'd say under Thielman and
Love doesn't establish.
Albertson.
You cited Love. Love doesn't establish a clear legal rule that was somehow abridged here.
No, Love established
the suggestion
that it would. And not that it would, but that it could distinguish.
It
yes,
could.
I think Love clearly presaged this by saying
There are conditions. Love raises the issue, but it doesn't establish a clear legal rule that was somehow transgressed.
And Love, there was an objection, so it wasn't plain error. It was abuse of discretion review.
Well, I mean, the first condition, the first factor is whether or not there was, whether or not the conditions are appropriate. And then we have to deal with whether or not there was the plain error standard.
Well, we don't have to decide the first question if we decide it's not plain error. Right.
Well, I think we have to decide whether or not it's error, and then whether or not that error is plain would be the.
We don't, and we usually don't. We usually say even if it's error, it's not plain.
Well,
so the first question you have to show us is actually that it's plain before we necessarily get to the error question. We don't have to decide the error question if it's.
I would say under Saro, there's a more deferential level of review for plain error. Plain error when it applies to sentencing, and additionally a greater scrutiny when the error complained of rises to constitutional dimension. So I think given those standards of review.
All those are true, but there's a split in the circuits about how this should be dealt with, which suggests there's not plain error.
And I'm not sure. Where is there a split in the circuits? I mean, there's this, if I may, I mean, under the Love decision, it sets it up that there is a distinction drawn between use of the internet to facilitate actual abuse of children versus transference of the images.
That's right. But the Eighth Circuit has held that simply printing the documents off of the computer, having them on the computer and printing them off, is enough of a use of the internet to permit limitations as compared to mere possession. So there's a string of, there's a possible spectrum of arguments here. One is merely possessing the images. Another is possessing them on a computer and, in this case, talking to somebody else about them and sending them via the internet. And the third is actually soliciting sex or whatever on the internet. And at least in the Eighth Circuit, the middle thing, which is what we have here, counts. And it's enough to permit this kind of condition.
What was, forgive me, I'm not sure which case from the Eighth Circuit you're referring to and what the condition was, whether it was...
United States versus Boston. Court upholds a lifetime qualified computer ban.
Computer, absolute computer ban?
Yeah. Well, look, usually this works the other way, and I have questions. But if you'd like to look it up, it's 494 F3rd 660.
I frankly don't remember it. I don't think it was in the briefs.
But that's a fault, not a positive thing.
And an oversight on my part, obviously. But I would say based on the Love decision, there should be a different level of...
The Love decision, I think, as Judge Griffith said, identified the issue but didn't decide it.
Well, it flagged it and noted that in other jurisdictions, that distinction has been enough to say that... A restriction as applied in this case was overly was a violation, and said that in the cases cited within the briefs that where there is not actual abuse or the internet is not used to facilitate actual abuse, and by that we mean contact with a child versus the dissemination of admittedly harmful pornography, that this restriction is overly broad.
Okay.
Then the other conditions besides the internet restriction, of course, are the second restriction about going to a library, bookstore, museum, any place. There was no guidance, any place that pornography or erotica can be accessed.
Under the definition of pornography or erotica, is there?
There's no definition of them. And that brings us into the realm of Loy as a violation. But I think in this case, the restriction is so overly broad and ill-defined.
Couldn't go to the Library of Congress under this, could I?
No, you could not go to, under this, under a strict reading of this, you cannot go to any library, any movie house, any cable TV, any bookstore, any newsstand. Because in all of those, some form of pornography or erotica might be offered. So it's a,
could we construe it by using the including clause, it meaning the condition, by using the including clause as indicating the kind of establishments that the court had in mind? And if we did, would that be sufficient?
But that's not what the prohibition is.
Well, we don't know what the prohibition is.
Well, it makes it,
it states a general one, a general prohibition, and then it has a list of examples. If we were to construe it as limited to those examples or things like those examples, there's a Latin maxim for this which has just escaped me, but maybe I'll remember by the end. Adjustum generis, I think it is. Would that be, would that resolve the vagueness question?
No, because those are listed, as the court noted, as examples. They are inclusive, not exclusive.
If we were to construe it not as examples, but as the kind of limitations involved here.
I would suggest you're still subject to the same infirmity because you're delegating to a probation officer. There's no guidance for the probation officer that says this is what it means.
What guidance would you recommend? If somebody had actually objected below, which they didn't, what would they have said?
They would have limited it to the examples, I think. To sites or stores.
So you're saying that if you limited it to the examples, it would not be vague. That's what you're saying to me.
I'd say it'd be less infirm if it was limited to those examples. Now, you might get into a problem defining what is an adult bookstore.
Right. So
but at least they'd have some limitation.
I understand your argument, but does that mean you're saying there's no kind of condition like this that would work? And the only alternative maybe is to lock him up for a longer period.
Now, obviously, that as an advocate for the appellant, that's not the position I would take.
So I think
it needs to be remanded for clarification.
I'm asking you again. If we were to construe this as limited to the kind of establishments that are listed here, not the Library of Congress, but adult bookstores, peep shows, adult entertainment establishments, where sexual entertainment is available, would you have the same objection? Or wouldn't... Let me put it this way. It's hard for me to see how much more narrow it could be than that. And if you have an objection, I'd like to hear what it would be.
No, if the restriction had been limited to adult bookstores, peep shows, etc., the types of things limited, stated as examples, then no, I don't think that would be inappropriate. Just like I don't think a ban on pornographic websites would be inappropriate. But to ban the entire use of the Internet, absent the probation officer, and to delegate the censorship of what sites are accessed to a probation officer grants too much of a limitation.
You think a ban on pornographic websites would have been okay? Is that what you just said?
Yes,
I do. What's the definition of pornography?
That's up to the Supreme Court to define pornography. I know, but whatever definition, there are definitions.
They knew when they saw it. It wasn't
right. That was one of them that was given. But there have been definitions given within the case law off the top of my head.
That wouldn't have caused you a problem.
If it had been limited to pornographic websites, no. I think that's an appropriate restriction.
Sorry.
Or to adult bookstores. And then, of course, the last condition.
But let me back up.
Go ahead.
But I thought your objection under the patronizing restriction was that it was an overly broad delegation to the probation officer. He wouldn't know what was permissible and what was not. And yet you just said if it
is. No. There is no delegation to the probation officer under the second condition of the ban against locations where
I thought you were making that point. I misunderstood.
No, the delegation of the probation officer, I think, applies to
treatment.
Treatment,
right.
Well, to the treatment and arguably to the Internet access, because you allow any use of the Internet has to be cleared with a probation officer. So, you know, you're basically putting the probation officer in, delegating to him the definition of, not the definition of what's pornography, but what sites can be accessed, when it can be used. It's an unreasonable restriction. The last issue, I think, is frankly simpler, is just delegating to the probation officer the inpatient versus outpatient rehabilitative treatment. And that, under Esperanza and Mike, cases outside of this jurisdiction, was found to be an unreasonable delegation, that it's up to, that the decision on whether somebody goes into residential inpatient treatment versus outpatient is such an infringement of the liberty interest that it should not be delegated to a probation officer. That decision
should
be made
by... Didn't we have the same problem there that we had before, that there's no clear legal rule on this? The Seventh Circuit allowed this type of delegation in Cutler. Doesn't that avoid the... Doesn't that raise the plain error problem right there?
I mean, it is a plain error problem, but I think it's such a fundamental fairness, due process... such a clearly constitutional issue, whether somebody goes inpatient or outpatient, and there's case law that talks about that decision should be made by a court, not delegated to a probation officer, that was the error. And that error rises to the level of plain error because it had been, but it's plain error because it is so apparent. Similarly, even
why,
if it's not...
Why, provides, so if the district courts thought that residential treatment was justified, you saying that the district court must order residential treatment and cannot leave it to the probation officer to decide that a lesser level of treatment would be okay?
I'd say if the court, you cannot have that infringement of liberty made on the decision of a probation officer.
That's the way I said it. If the district court thought that residential treatment was justified, are you saying that the following condition would be unlawful? You must have residential treatment unless the probation office finds that outpatient would be okay.
I would have to say yes, because it is delegating to the probation officer.
Well, if we remanded it, her only choice would be to either require inpatient or to require outpatient, but she wouldn't have this choice, which would suggest you'd probably end up with inpatient. I don't understand why this is better for your client or better for liberty. As long as the more rigorous treatment or more liberty-constraining treatment is justified, why can't she give an opt-out to the to a lesser treatment by the probation office?
And I guess I, to be consistent, I have to stand by my position that before you can take away liberty, the judge should make that decision.
She has taken away liberty altogether and said
residential is necessary.
Residential is necessary under my circumstance, under the hypothetical. Residential is required, but I will let the probation office provide a lesser treatment if it determines that you know, there's been enough progress or whatever.
That it's unwarranted.
Yeah.
That's a different decision, though, than the decision that was made. That's delegating to the probation officer the evaluation that at a certain point it is not necessary, and therefore outpatient should be allowed.
Isn't implicit in her determination here that inpatient is warranted? Otherwise,
nope.
She wouldn't have said, I leave it up to the probation officer to do one or the other. It's warranted, but maybe something less is also warranted. Would be okay.
I don't think that's implicit in her decision. I think her decision, it was probation officer decide what you think is warranted, whether it's liberty, whether it's residential and taking away liberty, or outpatient. And that was the violation. Now,
how about the number of visits a week if it were outpatient? Could that be left to the probation office?
Sure, because that's, sure.
But that requires the defendant to come in more times rather than fewer. That certainly constrains the defendant's liberty.
It's not the same, qualitatively, it's not the same level of infringement on liberty, I would suggest.
What if they had to come in 4 days a week, or 5 days a week, or 7 days a week?
That's a treatment decision to be made by whoever administers the program, and be the if that's delegated to the probation officer, then yes.
Yes.
Then those have been held to be ministerial.
Right.
And therefore, that is an appropriate delegation, but the one that was given is not.
You want to say anything about the ineffective assistance? I mean, the one that you have in your brief?
It's really the standard.
Here's what I'm not saying is, it seems apparent to me that what's going on here was a strategic decision. Less time, more constraints once you're out. And that the defense lawyer was making a judgment that if he objected to the conditions on the outside, his client might get more time. And that objectively seems like a reasonable professional decision. Why? And that seems objective on the record.
Isn't
that right?
The request from the defense counsel was for the statutory minimum.
I understand that, but
right.
But if he had made it, if he had objected to each one of the conditions, and if the court had said, well, maybe you're right about this, I should restrain them, the court might feel that the only alternative was to give more time to make sure that a longer time had passed before the person was out again. Well, that seems like a reasonable professional decision to make.
Yeah, I don't think procedurally, though. I mean, the time to object to those conditions would have been at the time of imposition, after the court had already imposed the sentence. So I can't imagine that a court would say, okay, I'm sentencing you to, in this case, 100 months under the following conditions. And then say, okay, well, if you're going to object to those conditions, I'm going to increase.
Well,
almost.
What if the court said, all right, you know, you're right, actually, about this internet thing. I can't put it on as long. but now I can't really trust to let this guy out in 8 years or whatever it was. Was 8 years? Was it?
Almost 100 months.
Now
8 years,
really
4 months.
Do that. I want to. I think I need to keep him in longer because I can't control him once he's out. You're right. I can't control him when he's out. So I'm going to keep him in longer so I can control him longer.
But I would take issue with your claim that I can't control them by imposing these conditions. I mean, there was control of the defendant, but certain conditions which would have adequately addressed it were available to the court. I don't want to talk over you.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is you don't think that the defense counsel could have thought that the court might not have taken kindly the idea that conditions that the court thought were necessary wouldn't work, and that the court might have responded by increasing the sentence instead.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that the conditions as structured presented infirmities, but the conditions could have been restructured to provide the same protection to the public with minimal modifications.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. The court did not err, let alone plainly err, in imposing the sentence in this case. I'll address appellant's claims in the order that he presented them.
Start with the definition of the erotica, that problem of the vagueness question.
Sure, and I guess I have a variety of different responses to that, Your Honor. One of the cases that's cited in the government's brief makes reference to the actual statutory scheme under which appellant was convicted as defining erotica. So I appreciate the court's point about defining pornography, but here, when you look at the provision, it uses examples. It's directed towards sexual entertainment.
Can you tell me which section you're talking about?
I'd have to look at the government's
statute you're talking about.
Yeah, it's cited. I don't know offhand. It's cited in the government's brief. There is a case. I think it's called Thielman, which makes reference to a statute defining erotica, and it defines a similar provision by reference to the statutory scheme. But that's actually not a load-bearing part of our answer.
What's a load-bearing?
Okay, the load-bearing part of our answer is, first of all, that you, as the court suggested earlier, you assess the condition in the context of it being directed towards sexual entertainment. And that is, the provision gives examples like, for example, a topless entertainment.
Yes, I'm asking you I don't see the topless part on here at all.
Well,
I'm asking you, are you agreeing with the court's suggestion, that is my suggestion, that you have to read this sort of in para materia or adjustum generis, that what the judge was trying to do in limiting patronization of places where pornography or erotica existed to things like the examples the court gave. Is that right?
That's correct. That's the way that we
would include. It would not then include going to the Library of Congress or going to a CVS that happens to have Playboy magazine or things like that. Is that right?
It would not, on a sort of common sense interpretation of the entire provision. But let me make a couple of other suggestions that supports that reading. First of all, appellant's case, Loy, talks about balancing interests here, and that certainly weighs in the government's favor. In addition, this court in Love...
I'm sorry, I'm uninterested in law for a moment. I'm interested only in the question of defining what it is that the person can't do. Now, and what is it that you think that the person can't do?
Well, I think in the example of going to a bookstore or 7-Eleven or something like that where adult legal pornography would be available wouldn't be the common sense reading of the restriction.
And that's because?
Because of the including language, that the restriction is geared towards places where sexual entertainment is available, and one wouldn't say a Barnes & Noble or 7-Eleven is a place where entertainment is available. You may be able to purchase.
So you don't read the first clause as being broader than the second. That is, it's not, although it uses the word any place, that it's not any place where erotica could be accessed, which would certainly include the Library of Congress, but rather it's limited by the examples that are provided.
That's correct, and that's a reasonable interpretation of that provision. And this court in Love made the statement on page 12 of its decision that we assume that the probation office is going to exercise its discretion reasonably. This court assumes that if appellant had a question about what this provision means and about his conduct once he's released from prison.
We actually can clear this up a lot better than waiting until then. If we accept what the government has just presented, and you heard the other side say that they accept that as not vague too, I think you can stop this argument.
I would agree, and that I would agree.
I cut you off at your first conditions. You have two more conditions.
If the court's satisfied about the discussion about that condition, I guess I'd move on to the computer.
I don't want to cut you off if you have more to say about it.
No, I guess I just wanted to say that it's the probation office that's interpreting the provision. That this court has said that the probation office is presumed to act reasonably, that they would use a common sense interpretation similar to the one that government is suggesting, that Your Honor is suggesting, that if that weren't the case, appellant has a recourse. He can discuss it with his probation officer. He can go to the district court for clarification. So even absent your suggestion, Judge Garland, that the inquiry is over because the sides agree on this limiting construct.
You're saying he has a safety valve of being able to go back.
Exactly. Even if that weren't the case, he still has a variety of options available to him. That being said, we can move on, for example, to the computer restriction. The computer restriction in this context, and both sides are asserting that the plein air standard is appropriate in this case, there wouldn't be any plain error, even if there were error, which I think is one of the suggestions the court made earlier. That Sullivan case, this court's Sullivan case, is very similar in terms of its computer restriction.
That 2-year restriction.
It may have been 2 years, but the restriction itself is the same. What's important in the cases that are cited in the government's brief, and including Sullivan, is that the appellant has a sort of an out. The probation office can authorize him to use the internet. It's not a flat ban. So it's dissimilar from the cases that have struck down computer restrictions. It's much more like Sullivan, for example, where the restriction was upheld. And here you have conduct, appellant's use of the computer, that supports the district court's judgment or supports the sentence. Appellant engaged in a chat. He did more than simply consume child pornography using his computer. He engaged in a chat with an undercover agent. He boasted about having raped a 6-year-old. He said he wanted to kidnap a child. He said he wanted to rape a young child. I mean, those are all things that drove the district court's decision in this case. And given the fact that this court's applying plain error, this restriction wouldn't be plainly erroneous, given the fact that, for example, a similar restriction was upheld in Sullivan. In terms of the last restriction, and that's treatment, and I think that appellant only addressed that briefly, again, as we indicate in the government's brief, the distinction there is whether the district court grants complete unfettered discretion to the probation office or not. And that's not the situation here, and appellant is not arguing that the district court gave unfettered discretion to the probation office. The provision...
Isn't the objection to giving to the probation officer the decision over the fundamental right, whether it's going to be residential, which has a sort of air of incarceration about it, or inpatient, where there's still a significant liberty interest preserved? That's the issue, right? And what's your authority that suggests that court can delegate that sort of fundamental decision to a probation officer?
Well, I think it's that Heckman case that's cited in the government's brief, but a similar restriction was upheld in that case. And I think as the court suggested earlier today, at most appellant...
Right, Heckman supports the delegation? I thought it cut contrary. I thought your best case was Cutler, but maybe I'm getting that wrong.
Remind
me of Heckman.
I think Heckman says that it was somewhat... It assessed this distinction. It said that as long as what the district court is, the discretion that is district court is granting to the probation office, as long as the decision to have treatment is mandatory, that the decision about inpatient or outpatient is a permissible delegation of authority. And that is the proposition that we have carved out in a variety of different cases that are cited in our brief. And Heckman, I think, is one. But there are other cases that make the same point, that the inpatient, outpatient distinction is a permissible delegation to make. Appellant has pointed to two cases on the other side of that. One is a Ninth Circuit case. But at most, as this court suggested, what he's pointed out is a split in the circuits. And given that, this court has repeatedly held that where there's a split in the circuits, an error can't be plain. And therefore, this court should affirm the sentence because the error wouldn't be plain. If the court has no further question, we would urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Zucker, we used up your time, so we'll give you a couple more minutes here to rebut.
I can really just respond briefly to a couple points. The Sullivan case, in addition to only being a two-year and therefore much less intrusive or much less expansive limitation, more critically, what was challenged in the Sullivan case was a procedural issue in the imposition of the restriction. It was principally a Rule 32 notice question. It did not deal directly with the constitutional issue of whether or not this was an infringement on the liberty interest. And then the only other point I want to make in my recollection of the Heckman case was, in Heckman, it was the reviewing court said that the trial court could not delegate to the probation officer whether or not treatment was necessary, but once the court determined treatment was necessary, it could delegate to the probation officer the decision as to which treatment. But it was, my recollection was, it was not an issue of whether it was liberty interest or non-liberty interest. It was the selection of what rehabilitation program among a variety of outpatient programs. And I'm not 100% sure that the inpatient outpatient was addressed there. That was my recollection of why Heckman didn't apply in this case. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Zucker, you were appointed by the court to represent the defendant. We're very grateful for your assistance.
Thank you, Judge.
Good day.